Welcome to the grand final of our All Sport 70 podcast series. To celebrate 70 years of All Sport, we've been picking out the greatest cars from motorsport history. And we've reached the grand final. We've got the winners from all the various categories. And now we're going to go through those and throw in a few wild cards as well. And joining me in this Herculean task, first of all, is our technical editor, Jake Boxall-Legg. Now, Jake, you've joined us on a couple of these. I know that you've obviously been following the F1 developments. It's been quite nice to go back a bit further and dip into the history of the sport a bit more.
Well, as I'm sure you've seen from the various features I've written over the years, where I've just delved back into some kind of random period of time and have written something about an old car. I always like dipping back into history. It's just so many stories there, and it's nice to be able to talk about them on this podcast series.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And my second guest is someone else who's been on a couple of these so far, and that is Marcus Simmons, deputy editor of All Sport magazine. So, Marcus, you're looking forward to this one. You've had two quite different ones you've been on so far: the touring car one and the junior single seaters. And now we're doing things either side of it.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone from stuff for people barely out of school to a form of racing that was for a long time described as old man's racing, but it isn't really anymore, is it? So the old cliche, "Never the twain shall meet," is never less relevant than it is today, and a career can take you anywhere. So yeah, interested to see how all these we're going to bring all these completely different disciplines together.
Yeah, it'd be interesting actually, when maybe on another podcast, see if there's any one driver that's driven all of the cars that we've got in the finals. It could be interesting. But
we had on one of our podcasts.
Yes, that was the touring car one. And my final guest is special in this context because he has not appeared on any of these so far. So he could be absolutely raging at some of the things that have been said and not included. It's our Formula E correspondent, editorial assistant, Matt Hugh. Welcome, Matt. You're looking forward to getting involved in the debate in the most important one.
Absolutely. I like to think we're doing this, deciding the best cars, and you brought on the best journalist for the best car finale. I hope that's the plan you had all along. Unfortunately, I wasn't available to discuss touring cars and make the case for the Vauxhall Astra Coupe, but hopefully I can sort of steer us all in the right direction for the one that counts.
Yeah, don't worry, folks. His knowledge and interest in the rest of the sport is much more accurate and helpful than his love for the Vauxhall Astra. So we'll move swiftly beyond that. So I'm just going to quickly go through the finalists from the rounds that we've had so far, and then we'll talk about the sort of wild cards and honourable mentions that perhaps didn't slot into those before we'll come back to the sort of the final six. So the winner of the greatest Grand Prix car was the Lotus 72. The greatest sports car was the Porsche 956-962. The greatest rally car was the Audi Quattro. The greatest touring car was the BMW E30 M3. The greatest Indy car was the McLaren M16. That was quite a tough debate, that was. And then the greatest junior single-seater winner was the Rolt RT3. And the first wild card I'm going to throw in, which we can discuss at length, we could do an entire podcast just on this car, is the Porsche 911, on the basis that if you're talking about iconic automotive designs, then it's up there with the Mini and the BMW M3. So Matt, I'll bring you in first, as you've not been able to partake in some of the other ones. Where do you think the Porsche 911 sits in this debate?
Well, first off, I'm going to ask you to clarify, because I think when we're discussing sort of 917s versus Mercedes W11s as the greatest car, that, you know, you have 1 year of that Mercedes Grand Prix car. Well, there's a 917, you have K, you have, you know, long tail versions, then you have /10, /30s in Can-Am. So to include 911, which has celebrated its 60th anniversary, and, you know, you can go from narrow body to Brumos wide bodies to current IMSA races, I want you to be a bit more specific, Kev, if that's all right. And then I can come in, because you've even got, I'm already first tangent, already got, you know, 911s masquerading as touring cars, which it definitely isn't in the British Saloon Car Championship way back then. Obviously, you know, wide bodied raised ones in the Dakar. So, yeah, I think we need to be a bit more specific there.
Well, that's the very reason I wanted to raise this, because the 911 did win in Rallycross. It won the inaugural Rallycross event, but it won in rallying, sports cars, GTs, did run as a touring car. In fact, at one stage, I think it was running in three different categories, but was basically the same car. But I think the point that Matt's made there is it can we really say that all the different cars that have been called 911 or have been related to the 911, the most extreme of which is probably, I guess, the 935, or you could even get into the 911 GT1s. Are we really just talking about a sort of a name or a brand that they're putting on rather than one design? What do you think, Marcus? Are we stretching it a bit to include the 911 as a whole?
Yeah, I think they're cheating a bit, aren't they? It is obviously marketing reasons why all these different cars since the 1960s have been called 911s. Although it is interesting in its own right that a basic shape of Porsche is still competing today at the forefront of international GT racing, which isn't that different to what it was back in the 60s. You know, if you just look at the silhouette outline of it, you can see the resemblance. But yeah, it's a bit like Chevy with Corvettes and Ford with Mustangs, isn't it? We're not going to say that a Corvette that raced in Trans Am in the late 1960s has got anything to do with the yellow beasts that have been at the forefront of GTLM or GTE in Europe over the last few years. So, I think it's a good idea to chuck it out there as a wild card, but I'm not convinced that it really fits.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And Jake, they've managed to overcome, one of the things that is impressive about the 911, they've been able to overcome basic physics, which is to have a fantastic handling car, despite the engine being not really in the ideal place, really.
No, it's sort of like in that overhang, isn't it? And it is amazing, even though we are now into the existential crisis of when is a 911 not a 911, are all 911s 911s. The end of the day is
it's a 991.
At the end of the day, it's a design classic, and although you know it might not go any further into this our own little competition because of all of these variables, it is a design classic, and it should be heralded for that very reason.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. And I mean, just to go back to what Marcus was saying, you know, you've gone air cooled, water cooled. They've moved the engine around, so that the latest car is kind of more mid engined.
Well, what about the 911 GT1? That's a 911. That engine was definitely in the middle.
Exactly. And what did that have in similarity with even the road going 911 at the time? Never mind the
Friday,
the car that pit 63.
It was a fried egg headlamps, but that was about it, I think.
Yeah. And I'm struggling to answer Matt's original question, which one are we talking about? And I think that's kind of the point, really. At least with the BMW M3, we're very quickly able to home in on the first one, on the E30. So I totally agree. 911, absolutely classic, brilliant design. But it's that had to have it mentioned, but that's why it hasn't made it into any of our debates thus far and obviously won't go any further. So two other cars I'm going to mention now. I do have a bit of a reputation for talking about old stuff, but I reckon this is pushing the limits even for me. So I'm just going to cover these off quickly. We did talk about the Peugeot L76 and the 1914 Grand Prix Mercedes in the Grand Prix podcast. The reason I wanted to mention them again, well, partly because I think they deserve to be, but also because they went on to win, both of them went on to win in the States as well, the Indy 500. So the Peugeot is a groundbreaker in that it brought a whole load of latest ideas together. Four valves per cylinder, dual overhead camshaft, hemispherical combustion chamber. Basically, to prove that you didn't need a 16-litre Fiat to win Grand Prix races was essentially what that was about. And they then went out and won three Indy 500s just before and immediately after. Well, one during the First World War. And the 1914 Mercedes, which I don't think was as revolutionary, but was run in the way that you would expect from a German team, rocked up very efficient 1-2-3 in the 1914 French Grand Prix. And then Ralph De Palma managed to, not smuggle, he got one from Mercedes, out of the factory as the First World War was starting, and then managed to use it to win the 1915 Indy 500. So two remarkable cars that I think did a lot for both the sport, automotive industry in general, and in the 1940 Mercedes case, it's almost the start point of their reputation in Grand Prix racing. So I wanted to give those a mention, unless you chaps wanted to suggest that one of those two should go any further. I will move on to the next car, which I will throw to Jake. Anyone want to talk about those pre-First World War cars? surprising silence there. I think also, to be honest, one of the factors that we looked at for this was fever factor, and I'm sure they were very fever at the time. But I think with, you know, with over 100 years of motorsport experience since then, they're not probably going to get you going in the same way that some of these other cars will. But the next car, I don't think the excitement rating is the problem here, but we haven't done a NASCAR round, but I couldn't not mention the Plymouth Superbird and the Dodge Charger Daytona, which are effectively the same car. So, Jake, you like big American over-the-top things. Why are we talking about those two?
Well, it's sort of like an interesting story behind the whole Dodge Charger Daytona, because the original Dodge Charger 500 wasn't particularly brilliant, and it's what eventually caused Richard Petty to leave the Plymouth team and go to Ford. And so Dodge sort of looked at him like, oh, our car's kind of rubbish, we need to create something. And this is like when NASCAR really first started to develop its aerodynamics a little bit further. I know we never think of NASCAR as an aero formula, but I think this is probably the one time it tried to be. So after Richard Petty left at the end of 1968, they built the Charger Daytona for 1969. They became known as the Winged Wonders because it had that colossal rear wing on stilts at the back of the car. It sort of had a nose cone as well. And it was the first ever NASCAR Cup car to get to 200 miles an hour in a race. That was Buddy Baker. And then the Superbird, moving on, that was an evolution of that. That's what Plymouth and Dodge used to get Richard Petty back. And I think it is the car that he is most associated with NASCAR, that sort of baby blue, massive rear wing Superbird. I think I remember first seeing it when I was playing Gran Turismo 2 as a kid, and I was like, what on earth is this? And it came in all these bright colours, and it was difficult to drive, and I was like, but for some reason it stood out to me. Obviously, back, you know, it's still something NASCAR has to do, the whole homologation thing. That's why you've got the cars that look like Toyota Camrys or Chevy Camaros or whatever. You know, they had to go and actually build the Superbird for a road car run. Petty went back, he saw the car, and he was like, okay, well, I'll come back to Plymouth. And he won 18 races in it during the 1970 season. The only reason that he didn't have a shot at winning the title was because he had a massive crash at Darlington. And the car flipped several times, and his head was scratching along the tarmac. And it is amazing that the only injury that he had was to his shoulder. Which, so funnily enough, on a side note, it's the reason why NASCAR cars have like the little side netting thing as a result of that crash, to stop the driver's head poking out. But it was a really short-lived car as well, which is a shame, because 1971, when they saw the aero formula that this car was developed to, they go, okay, you can either bring the engine capacity down or you can increase the weight to sort of peg it back a little bit. And the Superbird wasn't going to be very competitive, so they had to switch back to, well, they had to switch to a Dodge Roadrunner, which ended up being more successful, and Richard Petty won the 1971 Cup title, which was his third title. But I think when you look at that Superbird, it's so iconic. And I know it's probably not going to draw the favor of everyone else in this podcast, but it's a nice one to talk about, certainly.
Yeah, I think it immediately came to my mind when I was thinking NASCAR. It's such a sort of legendary shape. And also, as Matt will know, I've got a bit of a soft spot for any car that basically has to be legislated out of winning things rather than just being defeated by developments from the opposition. I think probably it falls down on two, maybe even three elements. One is, did it change the game? I suppose you could argue that it did perhaps increase focus on the aero thing, so that's quite good, but longevity isn't really there, is it? And I think we're also into, it's a bit sort of esoteric, isn't it? It's narrow, it's not a global car. It's the same argument we had with the Honda Civic Type R in the British Touring Car one. It is very much a sort of one-trick pony from that point of view. But I did want to mention it, and I didn't want NASCAR fans to be upset that we didn't mention it at all, because obviously there have been some cool NASCARs over the years. And another cool car, which I'm going to throw at Marcus, the Lola T332, which is another V8-engined machine, but a very different one. probably the greatest Formula 5000 machine of that time, that category.
Yeah, I'd say without question the T332 and the T330 from which it came were, yeah, without question the greatest Formula 5000 cars. Not just looking at it from a UK/European perspective, but also in the very, very competitive and rich American series at the time, which really, so that series in the States was really what became IndyCar a few years later when CART was formed and it, the races moved away from the ovals and onto the road and street courses. It was the lineage was directly from that American Formula 5000 scene via the Can-Am interruption in between. So and also Australia and New Zealand, where the Formula was really strong as well. A load of top drivers competed in it. You know, Brian Redmond, David Hobbs, Tony Brise starred in one at Long Beach in the pilot race there that they had in 75. Great car, good handling, as well handling as a Formula 5000 car could be. In the States, Mario Andretti and Alonso Race and Jody Scheckter. I might be wrong with Jody Scheckter. I think he may have been a bit before the T330. So I missed that bit out. that was a really, really strong car. Hasn't really fitted into any of our categories because I don't think you can count Formula 5000 as junior single seaters. And it's obviously not Formula One. Although, funnily enough, the first Formula One race I ever went to as a kid was the 74 International Trophy, which was Formula One and Formula 5000. And there were a load of T330/332s on the grid. but anyway, that's rambling a little bit. I just want to hark back to something you mentioned about the Peugeot and Mercedes from 1914, actually, because I don't know anything about the cars. But you then mentioned at the end the fever or excitement quota of them. And from accounts I've read of that race, it's one of the most thrilling motor races that was ever staged. Europe,
the 1914 French Grand Prix.
Absolutely. Europe was on the brink of war. Georges Boileau was the absolute ace driver at the time and he was kind of the Gilles Villeneuve of the Peugeot team, wasn't he? Doing an absolutely mighty job until disaster struck close to the finish and the Mercedes rumbled to victory with Christian Lautenschlager, whose grandson has been racing in TCR Germany in the past few seasons, incidentally. So anyway, there you go. You never know what these discussions are going to lead on to, do you?
Fantastic link there. Yeah, no, my point really about those was the kind of the test of would you watch one going round on its own? And I guess back in the day you would have done, whether you get the same feeling now.
Yeah, if you were standing by the corner of a narrow dirt road with Georges Boileau coming into view, I think you'd probably stay there and watch him doing that and be absolutely blown away, wouldn't you?
You probably would. And I think similarly, a well-driven Formula 5000 car would be something to watch as well. And Mario Andretti, of course, did reckon that with tyre development, had they been allowed to pursue that to the same degree, say in Europe, they weren't able to. They could have matched some Formula One times. They didn't normally. They were usually a little bit off. Peter Gethin obviously famously won the Race of Champions at Brands Hatch in 1973, but that was when all the F1 cars broke down, basically. So what do you think, Matt? My feeling is that perhaps the F5000 thing isn't quite pinnacle enough, not quite broad enough, world championship status enough to make it through to the sort of later stages of this. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I'm going to bring up a debate that won't carry much favour with you, but you're saying sort of it's cool how, you know, certain cars lead to the outlawing of certain regulations. And obviously 91730 is almost what put pay to the Can-Am, but it's worth to mention that the Lola T330 design was, you know, in essence, what Can-Am's revival was built around, this sort of low budget silhouette racer. And so, you know, for it to underpin sort of a whole series shows its enduring design, allowed Brian Redmond sort of pick up his design. That's one thing I will say. I know we've sort of had mentions of Mario Andretti, but when you think of some of the cars on this list, there's three or four, five or six different drivers that come to your mind immediately. With the Lola 330, I think it's sort of essentially Brian Redman on wheels. I think three US Formula 5000 titles, would have been a fourth if he hadn't have been sort of cup tied with Ferrari in Europe. But yeah, I think this is a point I'll probably bring up later on when we talk about one of our contenders. When we're discussing outright success and this sort of fever rating, I think really we have to be looking at top flight machinery. And I think Formula 5000 is probably just a bit too much of a tangent to that, as exciting and as much of a privilege it is to watch one of those cars go around the track by itself.
I think that's a very good summary of that situation. And yes, that's a very good point that it sort of helps the revival of the sort of second generation of Can-Am. And of course, it was quite a game changer in its own right as well, because it was, we talked to Simon Hadfield about this when we did the Lola piece a couple of years ago, and he was saying how it was really pushing the limits in terms of how big the car was, wide and long, and you know, extending the wheelbase and the aero. So very important car, one of Lola's greatest designs. But I think Matt sort of hit the nail on the head there, really, as to why it probably won't go through any further. But I'm going to bring Matt in again for a look into the future almost now, really. Is that we didn't have a debate about electric cars or alternative technologies in the previous rounds, but is there a recent car from that, say, Formula E that you've covered that we should be throwing into this as well as a kind of a perhaps the biggest game changer of all if we're doing this in 10 or 20 years' time?
Yeah, well, I know we had a couple of quick emails back and forth, and one car that came up was the Volkswagen IDR, but I've sort of sat back and thought about that, and that was really an aerofoil that just so happened to be powered by electricity. You know, it's still, to my mind, it's still Volkswagen bouncing back from Dieselgate with sort of a marketing ploy, and you know, it had to be towed to the starting line to have enough range to do a lap as impressive as its sort of Pikes Peak feat was. So, and the other one I wanted to consider was sort of the current DS Techeetah Gen 2 Formula E car for, you know, that's won back-to-back teams titles, back-to-back driver titles for Jean-Eric Vergne, Antonio Felix da Costa. But I think it has to be the Gen 1 Formula E car, not least because in that first season it won 100% of all the races it entered, which is quite a stat. But obviously, you know, the championship now is, we've just finished its sixth season, it's in rude health. There's still, you know, as many sceptics as there are fans, possibly more so. It's not great that the cars couldn't do a whole race, but from where they were pre-season, you know, breaking down in these test races to sort of putting Formula E on the map, and they were like the dependable thing. And amongst all the drivers coming in and out of the series, and amongst getting to Miami and there not being enough money for the race to start, the Spark first-gen Formula E car was dependable and got us to where we are now. It's an exciting sport and in pretty rude health. And although it probably, you know, criticisms are that it looked a bit too much like a generic single seater. It wasn't that fast. It was heavy. You know, it's a foundation for something that's potentially pretty great. So I think, yeah, it has to be the first gen one. And then I suppose if you wanted to be a bit more specific, I would say maybe the season two and three Renault Edams powertrain as the best one. Because obviously what Buemi did in a driver's championship, and then it was good enough for DS Techeetah to win with the customer powertrain.
Yeah, no, I think that's
okay.
Go on, Marcus.
Well, on the grounds that some of our junior single-seater contenders, we sort of went a bit on them because they were spec cars. I think on the same grounds, the first-generation Formula E car would not make the cut, as far as I'm concerned. And going on to the Volkswagen IDR, I'd like to see it compete in a competition where it's not almost guaranteed to win before we can put that up for discussion.
Yeah, it's certainly a fantastic record breaker, the IDR. I mean, obviously, it's got the Goodwood record now. It's it trashed the electric Pikes Peak record by a minute, but it's not a race car. And I feel like that's what kind of the criteria we're going on here.
Well, we got a competition car. We've included the rally side of things as well. But yeah, I think the one make point that Marcus makes is a good one. I think it is potentially going to be a groundbreaking car. We might look back on it a bit more fondly in years to come, but yeah, and also it's not quite fever enough, and it doesn't really tick your box, Matt, of it being quite at the pinnacle. You know, it's almost it's an electric version of F5000 in that sense. Lots of drivers who were nearly at F1, that's going to upset everyone. That'll upset literally everyone to liken those two together. but it's kind of like a subcategory. So I think the Gen 1 is probably the one to pick out from the electric cars we've had so far, although I agree with Jake, the RDR's cooler.
We will get rose-tinted spectacles one day, because all the cars are sat lying around, so there's inevitably going to be a historic Formula E championship set up somewhere soon.
Well, should we put Marcus Pye on to covering that and see what he makes of that? That would be some pretty fascinating columns and reports from that, I'm sure.
It won't be Rorty.
No.
I'm sure Simon Hadfield's got a couple in the workshop already being prepped.
Well, the good thing about Simon is that he doesn't switch off at particularly a year. He stays interested in everything. So, I mean, I'm sure he's got a little eye on a hybrid LMP1 car or a Formula E car somewhere. So, but yes, right. Anyway, so I think we've gone through some honourable mentions, cars that didn't really slot in to the debates that we did before. But I think we've come back to that original six that we talked about, and I think probably we could start off by knocking some of these off the list. I don't think we need to go into too much detail about the success of some of these cars at this point, because we've done that and they are obviously by definition some of the most successful racing cars that we've ever seen. So I'm going to kick this off and see if anyone argues with me in that I believe that if we're talking about the greatest competition car of all time, it should be one that is a destination championship, a pinnacle of whether it's touring car, sports cars, single seaters, and therefore automatically that would discount a junior single seater. So my bid would be to knock out the Rault RT3 as the first one to be lost from the six. I'm looking mainly at Marcus Simmons to see if he agrees, because he's a big junior single seater man, and the Rault obviously was a special car.
It was, yeah. And I can't believe you're not saying that the various national Formula 3 championships were the destination championship. Actually, they were for most of the people who did them.
Which wasn't really the point.
Obviously, most of the people who drove the Rault RT3 were not dreaming of driving a Rault RT3. They were dreaming of getting into a Renault Formula 1 car or a Brabham BMW or McLaren. So I can see your point. It was a phenomenally successful car. And actually, I've just been nerding out massively with some stats today on the RT3 with some of the drivers who won most races. And you've got names like Ayrton and Martin Brundle, everybody knows about. But other people you might not necessarily spring to mind straight away. Stefan Beloff, John Nielsen, Ivan Capelli, even in his year in the Italian Championship before he went to the European with a Martini. Gerhard Berger, Roberto Ravaglia won a race in an RT3 before going the tin top route. So a lot of great drivers raced it, and it completely changed the face of Formula 3. But as you say, yeah, the drivers in it weren't thinking, right, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. They wanted to move on to other things. So on on those rationales, I would say, you're possibly onto something there. It was a great car.
I think that's fair enough. It's probably as good as a yes, it can go as I'm ever going to get out, Marcus. So I'm going to press on while we're ahead, and I'm going to get Jake to nail us down to one single seater, because there's quite a lot of similarity and sort of parallel stories for the Lotus 72, which won our Grand Prix contest, and the McLaren M16 that won the IndyCar one. So would you like to talk us through those two and lose one of them?
Cool, sure. So obviously, I think we put the Lotus 72 through because it very much has sort of become... It changed how Formula One cars look, and it's brought us down the path of what they look like today. Formula One moved away from those cigar-shaped cars to, you know, what the Lotus 72 represented with the side pods at the side, the radiators at the side, enhancing the wings for downforce and all that kind of thing. The M16, it's not a groundbreaker as the Lotus 72 was. They're similar cars if you look at them visually. What the M16 did was it brought that sort of ethos to IndyCar. Partially that I think the Lotus 76 probably you'd argue perhaps did the same as well. But the M16, I feel, is quite strongly rooted in that 72. And if you're going to pick one of them, then you've got to pick the sort of the father of all of those. Obviously, the M16 was a great car. And that sort of developed into the, well, with Gordon Coppock designing both of them, the M23, which took James Hunt to a world title, well, took Fittipaldi to a title, took James Hunt to a title. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, if we're picking one single seater, what's the most iconic for everyone worldwide? Lotus 72, no question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna agree with that completely. I think also, if you're looking at the sort of strike rate of success, you know, the Lotus 72 won two drivers' championships, one with Jochen Rindt, then Emerson Fittipaldi, and three constructors' championships. It might have had a hat trick of each, except that it had the misfortune of coming up against Jackie Stewart. I imagine Jackie Stewart in a Lotus 72, that would have been something. But yeah, so whereas the McLaren M16, it did win three Indy 500s, but it actually kept missing out on the championship. They had quite a big fight going on with Eagle during that sort of early and mid 70s. And McLaren and Eagle sort of took it in turns of winning the Indy 500, but McLaren didn't actually win the championship very often. Roger McCluskey won it in 1973, and that's basically it. So the McLaren and the Eagles we talked about in the IndyCar podcast did definitely sort of change the way IndyCars looked and the way that was going. But I think, yeah, the genesis of that really can be found, as Jake says, with the Lotus 72. So the McLaren M16 is out, the Lotus 72 stays in. And I'm now going to throw to Matt, who I think has already hinted at one of the criteria he could use to remove another car from our list. So what do you reckon, Matt? What should we lose next?
Well, I don't want to go for a double hit, but I've kept coming back to the argument of Fever, and I can't decide whether I think what's more cool. Is it a thoroughbred racing car, or is it something that has led to some really cool homologation specials? And that brings us, I think, maybe to the two I would look to discuss next, which is either the BMW E30 M3 or the Audi Quattro. Kev, I can see you wanting to steer this a bit more. Do you want to dive in before I pick either or off?
No. I think that I think that is the kind of the crux of the question I was leaning towards. Is that my gut feeling is that the greatest competition car that we pick should have been designed as a competition car and not be a compromised road car, however special. And of course, with homologation specials, how much is it race car, how much is it road car, its initial design. But I think you've got to have, I think the winner of this should be a bespoke racing car or competition car. And I think that I, as you know, Matt, I'm a huge BMW fan, but I think for me, that's probably where the E30 M3, which I'd very much like a road car of, whereas I couldn't have that option with some of the other cars on this list, is probably the way to... It probably has to go at this point. Are there any objections to losing the E30 M3?
Certainly not for me. But one thing I will add is that didn't get a mention. Obviously, it was a British touring car podcast. But E30 M3, obviously, anyone who takes keen interest in that should definitely go to YouTube and hunt out Patrick Snires and the 1988 Manx sliding one of those as well around. Because obviously, great, you know, great car, you know, DTM with Van der Poel and Bavaglia, you know, world touring cars. N24, did it win four
Nürburgring 24s, four Spa 24s, and basically a championship in pretty much every continent that had one.
Yeah, quite. But yeah, anyway, basically go pick it out, see it on tarmac. You know, that Bastos motor livery is a hell of a spectacle. But I think possibly that's the next one to go on our list, and I would have picked the RS500 as the touring car winner. But anyway,
well, it's interesting you say that, Matt, because I can remember it being said in the podcast. I think that's probably because I said it, but for me, the Sierra RS500 Cosworth was the greatest car in British touring car championship history. But if you opened it up to include worldwide touring car racing, it would have to be the E30 M3, just because it was so successful in so many different championships across the world, to a level that the RS500 didn't quite achieve. But going back to your original argument, Kev, I would probably say I'd far prefer to see I know I'm more likely to choose a Formula One or Group C car or something than I am a production based tin top So I would agree with removing that and probably the Audi Quattro.
Yes, on that basis, we would have to lose the Quattro as well. Although I should think if we're talking about clips to pick out, I think there's a clip of Stig Blomqvist in the bewinged, smoking, fire-breathing Ultimate Evolution of the Quattro, which frankly is definitely not a road car. I think at the Thousand Lakes, which is an incredible piece of footage, but does show just how impossible that thing was to keep going in a straight line. He breaks even for humps when going in a straight line. I think by then the power of Group B had very much overtaken the chassis development and tyre development that Audi could muster at the time. So a fantastic car, but I think it does fall on the same basis, really, which leaves us, I think this is probably not a huge shock, but it leaves us with a straight fight between the Lotus 72 and the Porsche 956, 962. We've kind of lumped those into together. So just to go over the 962 stats, to put it up against the Lotus 72, which, as I say, won those five championships in Formula One, 20 Grand Prix wins, and some non-championship race wins as well. But the Porsche won six Le Mans 24 Hours, not including the 1994 race as a Dow 962, which was a bit of a swizz on the rules because it was entered as a GT car, which, I mean, Porsche have done some pretty amazing things with loopholes in the past, but I thought that one was really taking the biscuit. And also won the Drivers and Constructors Championships, or Teams Championships, as it became, between 82 and 86 under Group C. So I'd rather it not become a straight fight between do you prefer Formula One or do you prefer sports cars. So Jake, can you think of perhaps another way of looking at it, a technical way of looking at it to try and separate these two?
You put me right on the spot there. I don't really know, to be honest. I think you would have to probably look at them in terms of advancement and what they did for their respective categories, I think, which I, you know, it might be a difficult thing to do. Obviously, I'm going to be probably flying the flag for the Lotus 72 a little bit, but obviously, I think it has left an indelible mark on Formula One. But I suppose the Porsche has done the same. So, we'll have to kick this around a little bit and work out where we go.
I'll throw to Marcus on this. I've got a few thoughts. I'll throw to Marcus first, because in terms of wins, if you're looking at international wins and longevity, the 962 in various forms was around for 16 years. At one stage, sports car racing essentially existed because of it. So does that work in its favour, or does that work against it? Because at various points, it really only had to beat itself. So I'm not quite sure whether that's a strength or a weakness.
I'm not too sure that it's a weakness of it. What I would say is that in the years up to 1982, when the 956 came out, and it was the first year of the Group C regulations, sports car racing at an international level was absolutely rubbish. If the top 10 on the grid were covered by less than 10 seconds, you'd say that was a closely matched field. And sometimes it didn't even have 10 cars on the grid. So the fact that the 956 came along and then Porsche made it available to customers, and the 962 after that just really democratized that form of motorsport. Because of that, Group C enjoyed absolutely massive grids. And also because of the money that was coming into it, we were seeing a lot of the really exciting Formula One drivers of the time competing in them. Now, one thing it did do, but because of its numerical superiority, you kind of wanted the Lancia to win because the LC2 especially looked really cool in the martini stripes. It had people like Patrese and Nannini driving it, who were very popular at the time. And also the Lancia was usually hit by unreliability but was fast before it broke. So that was your kind of underdog car that you supported in those days. But the Porsche, I think, the 956 and 962, I think totally changed the landscape of sports car racing. And as far as I was concerned, made it something I wanted to watch and something I was interested in, which hadn't necessarily been the case before. So in that case, I think it's an an extremely important car. And you know, going to the Brands Hatch 1,000 kilometres in the 80s, it was well attended. There were good crowds. People were excited by it, and it was good racing.
That is a pretty strong case for the Porsche. What do you think, Matt? I mean, obviously, if we're talking about fever racing, both of these cars, you know, in the hands of a top driver would be fantastic to watch. You know, with the 962, the boost turned up, you know, Hans Stuck at Le Mans, or Ronnie Peterson in the late 72 at Silverstone. You know, these are all kind of some of the iconic motorsport images. If you're talking liveries, both cars, I mean, the late 72 had two of the greatest F1 liveries, JPS, Gold Leaf. And the 962, 956 had all sorts of different liveries. I mean, you could have a podcast just debating which livery you liked best on the Group C Porsches. So they were, and I think the 72 has longevity in an F1 context, which is also remarkable in a way that the Porsche has. Didn't democratise Formula 1, but I think that that's not something you could really hold against something that's at the pinnacle of the sport. So Matt, what's your feeling on this? Do you have a preference of these two?
I do, and I'll go straight out and say it's. I prefer my cars to have coverings over the wheel, so I'd go towards the Porsche 956 and 962. I don't want to rain on our technical editor's parade, but I want to bring in some of sort of the engineering developments, and I think it's worth reading out a correspondence we got about one of the podcasts from a chap called Ian Porter, who wrote in and said, "Hello team, I enjoyed your first podcast in the series on the best ever racing cars, which elevated the Lotus 72 to the rank of best F1 car. While you mounted very good arguments as to why it deserves that rank, I found it interesting that you never mentioned the fact it had torsion bar suspension. Given that one of your guiding criteria for the discussion was that the nominee should set a trend for the rest, did you avoid mentioning torsion bars because there were so many other aspects that were taken up by others? But just how many other manufacturers did take up torsion bars? Let me start the list. It's not a disqualifying factor. I thought such a relatively unsuccessful element of the Lotus 72 should have been noted." So, you know, appreciate Ian for writing it in. And I'm going to back his corner as well. So you have the wedge shape, the side pod radiators as these great innovations that really set the template and can still be seen now. But as for the rest, you know, the torsion bar suspension, the car was only really competitive once they got rid of the difficult anti-dive, anti-squat, and also inboard brakes never caught on. So I'd take that away from the late Lotus 72 and sort of bring in the Porsche 962 and say that was a technical pioneer in the sense of ground effect. So we'd already seen that in Formula One. But when sort of Norbert Singer sat down to design it, skirts wouldn't work. It was sort of shaping that air and having it running under. Well, that's another interesting point about the 956 is that the factory ones had a single under tray, which meant it had much better airflow than the customer cars, which had twin air trays and disrupted it a little bit. So they had to have front spoilers. But anyway, with the ground effect and also the fact that you had a Le Mans winner that had a production car key and would turn, you know, it's a turnkey start. I think that's very cool as well. So I'm not trying to argue in favour of the 956 and 962 by taking anything away from the Lotus 72, but in that sort of Chapman spirit, I wonder how many of those ideas were brilliant but weren't developed to where they could have been.
I think that's fair for the Lotus 72, and yes, the anti-squat, anti-dive, I think we did mention, but probably not the torsion bar suspension. But the Porsche for me is a little bit conservative at the time because they went for aluminium honeycomb monocoque. It was their first sort of monocoque car. It was pretty obvious that things were going to go carbon. You know, McLaren had already done that in F1. Ground effects were already a thing. You know, the Rort RT3 had already single seaters had already done ground effects long before the 956 appeared. So I'm not convinced that the 956 has a real groundbreaking credit to it either.
What about, can I play devil's advocate and say, although it wasn't an automatic or a paddle shift, it was the first ever used competition or road car used of a dual clutch gearbox, which obviously
yes, it did.
Volkswagen, yeah. Audi group, whatever it is, sticks by that religiously today even.
Yeah, and of course they did a lot of work on electronic control management on turbo engines. I mean, let's not forget that Porsche used that knowledge to go into Formula One with the tag engine in the back of the McLaren and sort everyone else out in Formula One as well. So they were obviously on the cutting edge of that side of things as well. Fuel formula, kind of looking ahead in that sense. So, yeah, I came into this with the expectation that the Lotus 72 would probably win. Marcus wants to say something.
I just need to clarify. I was just speaking up on why the 956 and 962 were great cars, but I was unaware that I was making the case for it. But actually, I would go for the Lotus 72. So at the time where I was talking about that, I wasn't. I was just going off the beaten track, obviously. But for me, it is the Lotus 72, because I don't really care about torsion bar suspension and anti-dive and anti-squat. I just like Ronnie Peterson going sideways at Woodcut. it was a troubled car when it was born, and Jochen Rindt even decided not to race it in the 1970 Monaco Grand Prix and raced the 49 instead. But it was a championship-winning car that year. 3 years later, 4 years later, it was still winning races with Ronnie Peterson. So longevity-wise, it was one of the most successful cars in F1 history. It's also one of the coolest, isn't it? And Emerson Fittipaldi became the youngest world champion in 72. Just so many evocative images from that era. And to me, it is just a classic of Formula One, probably the classic. And I think it's a generational thing as well. As a kid who grew up in the 1970s, and my mother-in-law, who's brilliant, smokes JPS. So, the Lotus 72 has to be it for me.
I think you touched on an interesting point there, is that every single one of the finalists was a car from the 1970s or the 1980s. And while I'm sure that people say there's an element of, well, that's because that's the age of the people involved in the discussion, actually, that's not entirely true, because most of the people that we've had on these podcast debates won't have been old enough, certainly, to see the Lotus 72 in action in Pyrrhus, nor the 960. I did as a kid, but it wasn't my favourite racing car. So I think there's something about pushing the limits, game-changing cars. I think from the 70s and into the 80s, you're then to a period where technology is ahead of circuits, if you like, and the quality of racing and expense. So rule makers in various championships have had to start clamping down on things, something that we moan about. But these are the cars, in a way, that made those things happen, because they were going to push the boundaries. I think the car that did it to the most was the 917, which is why that would have been my choice, but it got knocked out earlier, which is something I'm still trying to get over. So I think maybe if you, on the Lotus 72, you could also say that it was during a period where most teams, aside from Ferrari, a lot of the front-running teams had a Cosworth DFV and a Hewland gearbox. So to take the basic raw materials and still to change the game enough and to make a car that was so good, that was still competitive when everyone else had got some of the raw materials already at their disposal, is perhaps the real score for it. And of course, Lotus struggled to replace it. The 76 kind of came and then was sort of retired again. Lotus went into a bit, it was almost so good that Lotus went into a bit of decline. Porsche, of course, left altogether for a while after the 962, as they were overtaken by Jaguar and Sauber.
It became a bit of a recurring theme for Lotus, didn't it? Because the 80, which came along in 1979, and Colin Chapman said would make the 79 look like a London bus, was quickly dropped, and they wheeled the 79 back out. So it was a bit of a Lotus habit in the 70s anyway to succeed an enormously successful car with a complete lemon.
Well, we spoke to Clive Chapman about this when we did a very cool track test with some Lotuses last year, and he did say that obviously his dad Colin was always looking for the next big thing. So rather than necessarily refine and hone what he had, it was right, the next big step is this thing. And the Lotus 79 is perhaps the ultimate example of that, because while he was looking for the next big step, Patrick Head came along and went, I'm going to do a better version of that. And really, the FW07 Williams was what the Lotus 79 could and should have been the following year. And of course, Lotus never really got back after that. So JBL's gone for the, Jake has gone for the Lotus, Marcus has gone for the Lotus, Matt's gone for the Porsche, and I can't believe I'm going to say this because I actually love sports car racing. I kind of feel like having a Formula One car winning this and one that not just set the template for Grand Prix cars, as Jake said earlier, but actually all single-seaters have some of the traits that the Lotus 72 set, you know, the radiators on the sides, that sort of chisel approach, that reduce the frontal area. So I think, unless Matt is going to make one last bid for the Porsche, I think that we are going to end with Autosport's greatest competition car of all time is the Lotus 72 Formula One car.
I can come back with several arguments that could be shot down immediately. I can have a go at that. So I think, I know it's been said that the 72 was successful till the end, and also that, you know, it had to be wheeled back out because of the 76. But I would sort of say, you know, 1975 season, no wins either in World Championship or non-championship races. And you know, by then you had sort of the 312T and the BT44 were better cars. But I think if we judge racing drivers by that same criteria, you always want them to stop at the very top, don't you? And I wouldn't hold the Lotus 72 in quite that esteem. I know then to stretch the debate, you could talk about the Dower 962, even the Crema K8 Spiders that obviously won Daytona and kept winning championships. So I like to think that that car did go out at the top. I can see you shaking your head, Ken.
No, I think you've done in your own argument there. Right. You have given the final nail in the coffin for the Porsche, because that car did stay on in Group C forevermore and became make weights back of the field while Jaguar, Peugeot, Mercedes were going at it. The Dower 962 can't count in this, because from that point of view, because it was a massive rules cheat anyway. And I say I'm a big Porsche fan, but that was very cheeky. That's not what they meant when they wrote the GT rules, was to get a Group C car back in the race again. The Crema K8, I think, was around when sports car racing was having one of its dips. I don't think you would have said that was in itself a great car. So, yeah, the Porsche were basically, the 962 was defeated in 1987. Tony Southgate's XJR8 Jaguar really knocked it out. And Porsche focused on Le Mans for the following year, didn't do any of the championship rounds, and lost to Jaguar at Le Mans as well. So I think it was definitely done and dusted then. They got one more win after that due to a tyre thing the following year. But I think that the 962 had its decline in old age, just as you were suggesting the Lotus 72 did. So you've almost convinced me that the Lotus 72 is the right one to go for in this.
I can sense I'm losing this, but I think both Hurley Haywood and Bob Wallach, Bobby Rahal, described the 962 as the best car of all time. So I'm happy to be in that company.
That is good company. Now, one thing I would say about the 962, which Marcus did sort of mention earlier, was back in the day, you could have aspired to be a Grand Prix driver because if you were rich enough, you could have gone and bought a 250F, and you could go and do the Indy 500. I suppose you could argue you could still do that now. But really, the top end of single-seater racing is not the same. Whereas sports car racing and Le Mans, as an amateur driver, that you can build up to get there. And obviously, the 962 was good enough to allow the aces to strut their stuff, but also the privateers to go and race their dream as well. But I think that's more a nature of Le Mans and sports car racing. I think that'd be an unfair thing to compare against Formula One. And of course, the Lotus 72 did appear in privateer hands as well. So another couple of cool liveries it had in privateer hands. So let's just say perhaps that the Porsche 962 is the greatest customer racing car ever produced. I think that's probably a fair shout. But the greatest competition car of all time is the Lotus 72. So I'm going to try and finish now before Matt jumps in with another argument.
No. I would agree with it if we could nail it down to like the Lotus 72D, but no.
No,
/962. I don't think that's probably a straw man argument.
I think that I was going to say exactly that thing, yeah. Especially as you did use the words Dower and Crema just now as well. So I think that's a bit harsh. So I'd like to thank you, the listener. Do let us know. We've had some nice messages about it. Let us know which car you think should have won. Did we miss one that we should have been talking about and should have been in this final? The answer, of course, is the Porsche 917, but I'll stop going on about that. Let us know. Autosport@autosport.com. Look out for our special 70th anniversary book-a-zine, special edition of the magazine, which will come out in the second week in November. And we will have features and interviews with all of these cars, and with a whole range of other things, greatest drivers, greatest races. It's going to be quite a big undertaking for us over the next few weeks. So look out for that. So that just leaves me to say thank you very much to Jake Boxleg, Marcus Simmons, and Matt Hugh. That is the end of the Autosport 70 miniseries.
Well, if you enjoyed this edition of the Autosport podcast, a reminder that our greatest competition car, the Lotus 72, is the subject of a special issue of Autosport magazine this week. As well as telling the story of the legendary F1 machine, we speak to some of the key figures, including double world champion Emerson Fittipaldi. Autosport magazine is out on the 8th of October.
Music is 6 AM by Trilo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trilo Music.